Good morning. We've stopped along Highway 101 today for some refreshment in, as it happens, a restaurant that has consistently been selected as the best in the USA. So you'd probably expect it to be very pricey and extremely posh. In fact, it's neither. That's because of the philosophy of its owner. Alice Waters started Chez Panisse in Berkeley in 1971. It came out of her devotion to French cooking and has spawned a culinary revolution across the USA and beyond. Earlier this month, she flew to London to accept the Lifetime Achievement Award at the World's 50 Best Restaurants Awards ceremony. She's only the third recipient and the first woman. She's the leader in the USA of the slow food movement, the author of more than a dozen cookbooks, and her cuisine is probably as much about politics with a small p as it is about the palate. Alice Waters, you're very welcome.
Thank you.
You probably should be welcoming me as we're actually conducting this interview in your restaurant, but you're just back from a visit to Ireland. What brought you there?
I have a very good friend at Ballymaloe, Myrtle Allen, and her son, who's married to Darina Allen. They're all good friends of mine, and Darina's brother, Rory, invited me to celebrate my birthday there with my daughter, who's studying in England right now.
Was there anything in your childhood, in your youth, that would have led anybody to suspect that you'd end up where you have today?
Not really, because I was a very picky eater when I was a child. In fact, my parents had a victory garden during the war, and so they always kept a little plot in the backyard. I did like to eat the strawberries and loved the corn, but my mother wasn't a good cook. She cared about my health and that I ate 3 square meals a day and all of that. And she insisted that we come to the table. But that was just part of life in the United States, certainly in the 50s.
And your father, I presume, is somebody who never darkened the door of the kitchen.
He only was in charge of the barbecue out back. He grilled the steaks. That's what he did. But he was working so hard and always came home late. It was just difficult for him to do anything other than his job, really.
Lots of people describe you as an ex-hippie. Is that the case? Were you in any sense a hippie in the 60s and early 70s?
Oh, I don't think of myself as a hippie. Maybe I was more in the beatnik side, but I was involved with a lot of the philosophical, idealistic dreams of the 60s, and certainly engaged in the free speech movement at the University of California.
Tell me a little bit about the impact that that had on you at the time.
And I was very empowered by it. I just felt like I was part of this counterculture and that we didn't have to, go shopping over there at that big store. We could stay in our little neighborhoods and support each other. And that, in fact, is how Chez Panisse started. I wanted to cook and I wanted to have my friends for dinner. And why don't I open a little place down the street from where I lived? And then my friends could come over and they could pay a little something. And I started it out by paying everybody who works at the restaurant a little bit too much because we went into a lot of debt in the first 4 months, the first 8 years, in fact.
The where is obvious, but when did you acquire your devotion to French food?
I went during my junior year in college to France, and I didn't go for anything other than to learn how to speak French and to take some courses in Paris. But it was a moment in time when people, shopped every day at a little farmer's market and stood in a line to get their hot baguette. And it was the way that people related to one another was around the table of a little tiny restaurant. And I had never thought about food like that before. I'd never even eaten an oyster before I went to France. And I had an awakening. It was sort of a revelation to me to see this kind of vibrant, conversation happening very political, it seemed to me, very connected to art, to music, to the whole culture, of the bigger culture. It wasn't just the food. I mean, food was sort of the vehicle. I mean, the gathering around the table, or the shopping in the marketplace. You'd talk to the vendor, you'd meet your neighbors, you began to understand how dependent we were on each other, and it just took this all in osmosis. And of course, the beauty of it all was eye-opening. The ingredients, the varieties of cheeses.
Just to get back to the beginnings then of Chez Panisse, you, as you said, you cooked a lot. You liked to cook. You liked to cook for friends. Was it just a decision, really, that, well, why not make a living out of something that I actually enjoy doing and that I'm pretty good at?
It was definitely like that. It was just that I was teaching school and I was struggling to teach these little 3-year-old kids, and I decided, well, you know, I love to cook and maybe I could make a living at it. And it never occurred to me that I would need some experience. I thought waiting on a table, tables in a restaurant during college was plenty. And the fact that I actually cook for a lot of friends at home, that was experience enough. So I just really started out in that very naive way.
And was there anything as highfalutin as a philosophy behind Chez Panisse when it started off in 1971?
Oh, yes. I wanted to be one of those little French restaurants that served, you know, made people feel like they were part of the family. I really liked that. And I didn't want anything complex. I just wanted, the omelet with herbs, or the simple little roast chicken, and the beautiful salad, and the bowl of wild strawberries. But I had these tastes in my mind, really had the taste. And that's what I wanted to present to in the dining room. And I was not compromising about that.
And the food itself, did it always have to be organic, for example?
Oh, at the beginning, certainly I had some of that in me from living in Berkeley in the 60s. And just the politics from my family. But really, I wasn't focused on that. I was focused on flavor. And what happened was, in my search for flavor, I ended up at the doorsteps of the local organic farmers. So that's how that happened. And then I realized that they were dependent on me and I was dependent on them, and that I should talk about that, that it was something really important.
The name Chez Panisse, you could have called it Chez Alice or Alice's Restaurant or something more prosaic than that. Why Chez Panisse?
Well, some people do call it Alice's Restaurant, but at least way back then. But I fell in love with the films of Marcel Pagnol that were made in the 30s in France, and I just loved the spirit of them. And one of the characters in the films was called Panisse. And he's the only one who made a little money. So I thought, well, that would be a good association. And it's also the name of a little chickpea pancake that they make in Nice. It was called, the word Panisse sort of comes from the pan de Nice, the bread of Nice.
And I will have to ask this question with a certain delicacy, because we don't want to incriminate anybody, but is it true that some of the early investors perhaps might have made some of their money from selling certain recreational drugs?
Oh, who knows about those things? I never asked. I just took the money.
Who did invest in it? Because, I mean, it was mainly friends. It was people in the area, wasn't it?
It was really my parents who made the biggest investment by mortgaging their house and giving me the money to start. But we began with very little, $10,000. Of course, that was back in 1971. But still, that wasn't very much to begin with, and especially when we had 50 employees.
I want to talk to you about the opening night where you used those 50 employees, because it comes across as being organized chaos. But French restaurants at the time, and I mean, it continues to this day, many of them would be seen as being very, very stuffy and quite posh. You were determined, I presume, to avoid that.
I was determined to avoid it. I wanted a sort of well-lit place, and we had, you know, oilcloth checkered tablecloths and bouquets of flowers, wood floors, very, very sort of country French in feeling.
Tell me about opening night. As I say, it comes across as being organized chaos at times and utterly disorganized chaos at times.
Well, it was all of that. I remember sort of hammering in the rug that was going up the stairs as the folks were coming in the front door. I do remember that, and sort of scrambling to prepare myself to greet them. But lots and lots of people came, and we never really cooked professionally. None of us had. The desire was there to please people, but we kind of ran out of food, I think, at some point. And I was just worried that people wouldn't come back.
I think the time lapse between courses tended to get longer as the evening went on, didn't it?
I think that was the way it went. I don't remember really all the details. I've heard them from lots of people who worked that night, but it's all a bit of a blur.
How do you employ 50 people in what was then a relatively small restaurant? It hasn't actually got physically an awful lot bigger since then, mind you.
Well, I wanted this salad that was made out of small lettuce leaves. Now, back then, I didn't realize that you could actually grow lettuce to a particular size and just cut it, and they were small. And we thought that we had to take the hearts out of all of the lettuce. And I wanted them washed specially and carefully handled. And then I wanted every leaf down on a towel, individually laid out on the table. No rolling it up. I wanted it completely dried that way. So that took one person probably 6 or 8 hours to do. I don't know. We had one person who did salad all day long. And this was just to serve 100 people. But that was his job.
At the end of the first night, did you sit down? It would have been, I'm sure, the early hours of the morning. Did you sit down and think, okay, we survived that one, but how in the name of God are we going to do it tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow?
I never questioned it. We just did it. I really never questioned how we were going to do it. It was just, I just had to have the right people, and I guess if I had enough of them, I would feel comforted by that. But it was just moving so quickly that you were just swept away by it, by the opening of the curtain every night. You had to be prepared.
So there was a huge freewheeling element to it. Now, there were obviously positive aspects to the freewheeling element. There were negative aspects, because I think there was something like $30,000 worth of wine disappeared down people's throats unaccounted for in the first year. Do you have any idea where that went?
Oh, just right down people's throats. I couldn't pay attention to that. I was so interested in the taste of that food and that people liked it. I wasn't interested in making money. That wasn't my primary motive. And I wanted people who worked there to have a good time doing what they were doing. So if we sat at a table after we were finished and had a bottle of wine, that was all part of what it was to be in business, because that was the kind of business I wanted to be in.
It wasn't making money in the beginning. I mean, you were basically producing, you were charging something like $5 for a meal, which was producing costing $6 or $7 to actually make.
Is that how it worked? I'm not quite sure, but I wasn't paid for 8 years. I know that. And I sort of lived, with my friends who took care of me and ate at the restaurant.
How did you stay in business?
I think we stayed in business because a lot of people liked the informality of the restaurant, liked the spirit, liked the idea that we only had one menu a day. And they'd look down the week's menu and find the one that interested them the most. And this was extremely unusual for a restaurant.
But it was quite stressful for you as well. I mean, you make it sound as if it was wonderfully freewheeling and interesting. And stressful to the point where I think you occasionally actually lost your eyesight, lost your sight, didn't you?
Well, I had a few moments of collapse during the first year, I know, when I just worked too hard and was under such pressure that my body was telling me, stop, I'm going to just close this down if you don't pay attention.
In late 1975, you got a rave review in Gourmet magazine, but that, I think, that proved to be a bit of a double-edged sword in a sense, wasn't it?
At once, you know, a very credible magazine or newspaper gives an, you know, such an award, it brings in people that want to go, maybe not for the right reasons, want to go because they, you know, they've just heard about it and have a lot of expectations about what's going to happen when they go to, you know, what they think might be a 3-star restaurant. We had a very hard time living up to those expectations. And so you're very busy on the one hand, and you like to have the restaurant full, and on the other hand, you're having, you know, people are pushing on you, very critical and expectant. And it's a hard balance to keep.
And I think also that year you were actually physically attacked in your home, which must have been a horrifying experience. What happened there?
Oh, somebody broke in when I was sleeping. And fortunately, I escaped. But it was really a moment that woke me up, really woke me up to what, how I was living, what, you know, how I needed to take care of myself.
And around this time, I think about a year or so later, you actually put the restaurant up for sale. Were you disillusioned at that stage?
I think it's very important for a restaurant to be self-reflective. You want to be doing, I want to be doing it for the right reasons. I want the people who are in the restaurant to be working there for the right reasons. So it's kind of a yearly thing that you just say, is this what we all want to be doing together? Or do we want to be doing something else? And if so, maybe we should close it. And it doesn't matter how much acclaim you have. It doesn't matter about anything other than, is this the right thing to be doing? And maybe at that point I was discouraged because people had left who were important to me, or I can't remember the circumstances of it now, but I said that often. Shall we stop? Or should we continue this dance?
From the point of view of the food on offer here in Chez Panisse, contrast what you were doing here to what was happening in the restaurant and catering business in the 1970s in America. I suppose I'm really talking about the rise of fast food.
We were on that slow food track from the very beginning. We were looking for those ingredients, those really tasty ingredients, and we were going out into the countryside and picking things. We were foraging, actually, for the food that we used in the restaurant, picking fennel alongside the roads. And it was a big search that we were on. And ultimately, it led us to the sustainable farming movement. And we now have a network of suppliers, probably 75 in total, who supply Chez Panisse with food from one season to the next.
Meanwhile, a lot of other people, most other people, were involved in fast food and were taking their food from large agricultural corporations rather than farmers.
Exactly. And the whole idea for us was to focus on time and place and seasonality and diversity and aliveness. What was going on in this country was the reverse. It was the uniformity of food, It was the availability year-round, the globalization came in the eye, the narrowness of the food choices, the waste, the portion size associated with that sort of cheap fast food. And so what happened in this country is that the fast food has educated our population into a set of values that have to do with fast, cheap, and easy. And what was happening at Chez Panisse is that we were developing a whole different set of values that were built around slow food, if you will.
And you did become a sort of a hunter-gatherer, as you said. If you wanted fennel, you went out to the highways and byways and you found it and you picked it. But how did you manage to spread from the early 70s to begin to spread that philosophy of sustainable, local, fresh, slow food cuisine to other parts of America, to the rest of California and then beyond California?
I think it certainly had to do with taste, because people who came here to eat liked what they ate. And we used to write, we still do, write on the menu where the food came from. And they put these two things together. And so people, when they come now in February to Chez Panisse, they say, "Do you have Jim Churchill's Kishu tangerines?" And I said, "Well, they're coming next week. I think he's called up and they're going to be available." But it's that kind of thing. They know who Bob Kennard is and they want to go and visit his farm. And it's just, it happened maybe more quickly at Chez Panisse than in another restaurant, because we only had this one menu a day for the first 10 years. So every day it was different. And we had to find new things to cook with. That we were, you know, and we were fine-tuning all the time. We had the focus to fine-tune.
But no strawberries in January.
No strawberries in January. Only tomatoes 3 or possibly 3.5 months out of the year. And as soon as you understand the beauty of that, when you understand that that's the only way that you're really going to have ripe, tasty food, it becomes easy to make those really what seem like hard decisions. I'm not going to have salmon except during salmon season, and that's from the beginning of May until the beginning of September. That's it. That's when I'm going to have it. And then I'll have crab in the winter.
Do you think people are spoiled by the fact that you can fly in strawberries or tangerines or kiwi fruit or whatever it is from 3,000 or 6,000 miles away?
I don't think of them as being spoiled. I think of it in an entire. I think of them as being deprived, because they're eating second-rate strawberries all year long, and I get to eat the best-tasting strawberries ever if I wait until May and June, July. And I have that beautiful experience in my life. And I'll have something else in August and something else in September. That's something that's really misunderstood. This availability is not desirable.
But you've said that people will have to get used to paying more for food because farmers need to make a living, for example. The fact of the matter is that even in a country as rich as the USA, a lot of people cannot afford or think they cannot afford the kind of cuisine or lifestyle that you're talking about.
They think they can't afford it. But people are willing to spend money on cell phones and portable TVs and fancy cars and gym shoes. And I'm not talking about the people who have no money, the people who are homeless. That's a whole other issue. But there's a lot of disposable income. And people make value judgments about it. And we spend less on food than any other country that we think is civilized. So I think we have to understand that you know, you're going to pay one way or the other. You either pay up front or you pay out back in terms of your health and the health of the planet. Or you pay up front and you give the farmers what they need to continue to grow this food that is nourishing you and delighting you.
How popular are you with large agricultural corporations?
I suspect I'm not very popular because I'm interested in the small farmers. I really believe that size is very important to this, the way that people can take care of the people who work with them and the land that produces that food.
Why did you cook the film director Werner Herzog's shoe?
Well, my friend Tom Luddy is the director, who's the director of the Telluride Film Festival, was in fact the person who named Chez Panisse. And his friend was Werner Herzog. And his other friend was Errol Morris. And they had a bet that, how shall I say this? Werner said to Errol that he wouldn't make this film. Or was it the reverse now? Errol said to Werner. Anyway, he said, if you do make this film, I'll eat my shoe. And so Tom Luddy suggested that perhaps I should cook the shoe.
How did you prepare the shoe?
Well, I thought it would be a very good idea if I made a confit. You know, with a lot of fat, somehow, you might be able to soften up those rubber soles. In fact, even though I cooked it for hours in duck fat, it never was made edible.
I think he actually did attempt to.
He tore a piece off there. But I think he had a hard time chewing it.
Give me an example of a food or a dish that you think should not be on the market in the USA, for example, because it's just not sustainable.
There's lots of fish on the market right now that are being brought in from all around the world from companies that are not sustainably taking care of the oceans, not fishing according to rules and regulations. And that fish should not be on the market. I think that meat that's raised in unsustainable ways, animals that are fed hormones and antibiotics should not be on the market. They're harmful to people and terribly harmful to the environment.
Let's say, God forbid, you are a condemned woman.
Oh, no.
You get to choose your last meal. What would it be?
Why is this always the question that's asked? Well, it depends.
People want to know.
Well, I think it would depend on what season it was and where I was where I was living.
So, okay, you're condemned to death in California in January.
In January,
dismal time to die.
A dismal time to die. I might just hang on for another month so I could have the...
Okay, you'd go to the Supreme Court again and again and again until what time of the year came around?
Well, I think I'd probably hold out for September and the figs. I'd hold out for the figs in September, the Adriatic figs. And I've always loved tomatoes and garlic, olive oil. I can be very happy with those three ingredients.
Okay, we promise we'll get you a good attorney and he or she will keep things going until September. Kids are very important. As far as you're concerned, and their attitudes to food are very, very important. Tell me about the Edible Schoolyard project that you've got going here.
Well, it's a project that we started 12 years ago in a public school here in Berkeley. And the idea that I had was to bring children into a new relationship to food. And I thought if you could really take over that school lunch and engage the kids in the making of their own school lunch. And if you could show them where their food came from by making a garden, and the kids could work in that garden, that they would begin to, you know, sort of open up their senses, and they would begin to to taste, and they would begin to really see food in a different way, really. That was what I was hoping for. And this was a school, a middle school in Berkeley, not far from the restaurant. And so these are children that are teenagers. And I thought, well, if we could work with teenagers, then everything else would be easy to do this kind of program in the grammar school. So, in fact, when the children were brought into the garden and into the kitchen classroom, they really liked it. They didn't feel like they were in school. And even though they were, you know, making worm boxes and doing scientific experiments out in the garden, they felt like they were having a good time. So we were bringing them to these ideas through pleasure. And they learned very quickly about what was important. They began to know what was in season at what time. They know what compost is. They learned how to make salads and salad dressing. They'd like sitting at the table because they don't sit at the table anymore with their families. That's the very sad part, and the reason that we need to have a curriculum in the public school system is because kids don't eat with their families anymore. They aren't learning about our culture through that experience of dining together. Kids aren't eating at home with their families anymore. They're not sitting around the table. They're not learning how to share. They're not learning about, you know, what's important in the world. They aren't learning a set of values that's important for the future of this, our time on this planet. And it's really important that the public school system, which touches every single child, be a place that teaches children about stewardship of the land, that teaches them about nourishment, and teaches them about communication at the table. I think this is like the essential information that we need to know to live on the planet. Everybody needs to know this. And if we had a curriculum in the schools that centered around the school lunch, that was interactive, where kids were involved with, you know, not just with their heads, but with their hands, that they could really come into a new relationship to food that was meaningful, that they could be connected to nature again and connected with the traditions of our culture. And so I had this wonderful opportunity at a middle school in Berkeley called the Edible Schoolyard. We called it the Edible Schoolyard, where the teachers in the school, whether they be in history or drama or English, bring their children into our garden classroom or our kitchen classroom. And instead of teaching kids who are all sitting in their places, they're using food to teach geography, you know, when they make an Indian curry. They're talking about India, and the kids are smelling India as they prepare the spices. They're learning improvisational cooking, and which is part of a drama course. They're out in the garden, and they're learning about irrigation, which is part of a science class. And it's brought these subjects alive for them. And at the same time, they're learning what's important about food. That they're learning about seasonality and about sustainability. And it's just coming in osmosis. So I just figure that if we had this course, I'm calling it eco-gastronomy, that if we began with very small children in all the schools, and the kids participated in the making of their own and the serving of their own school lunches, that we could really change the values of of this whole population.
Have you already started doing that? I mean, you've been doing this for 12 years, so presumably some of the kids who started the Edible Schoolyard Project 12 years ago would now be in their mid-20s. Do you know what kind of influence it's had already?
Well, I know that it's been very important to many of the children who've been in the project. They come back and they work in the summers, that there's a word of mouth that has gone out. We haven't done the evaluation that we're in the process of doing now. But what's really important is that it's an everyday experience. When the cafeterias all need to be rebuilt in our school system, and the one that we've been waiting for at the school, it is still delayed. And it's not an everyday experience for every child. I think every child should eat at school, and that the food that they eat should be purchased from local sustainable farms. It would sort of build the economy of the place, and at the same time, it would give the kids the most nutritious food to eat. And so it's something that really has to be instituted and paid for by the city government, the state government, the federal government. It's not something that can just be, financed by philanthropists. It can't happen that way. We can make models, but this takes an enlightened leadership.
It can't happen in an environment of tax cuts after tax cuts, can it?
It can't possibly. But we have to see the relationship of, our own health, the health of the nation, and put that against the amount of money that we put into the school system to feed our children. And we had, many years back, a curriculum that came into the public school system around physical education, and we rebuilt gymnasiums, and we insisted that every child take a course in physical education 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 times a week, and they got graded for their performance. So I think that children should be graded for eating their school lunch.
Example is very important as well, and example all the way from the top. And I know that you weren't particularly impressed with the example, the culinary example, if you like, created by former President Bill Clinton.
Well, I was very disappointed that he would stop by and eat in fast food places, eat on the run, because it sends the wrong message to everyone that food isn't important, that you can just have it any time and just quickly, and that the gathering at the table is something that can be easily dismissed.
You've been doing this now for 35 years. Are you still discovering things that you never knew before, or have you pretty much got on top of it all at this stage?
Oh, I'm always discovering things. This is both in terms of the restaurant and certainly in terms of the importance of food and agriculture as making change. I just know that food is a way to really make change in the world, that the decisions you make every day about what you eat have consequences. And they can be supporting the people who are taking care of the land. They can be enriching your cultural life, or they can be destroying it globally. So it's very important that we be educated about those decisions.